I'm Jim Stubendick. I'm the director of the center. Well, before coming the coordinator of the Tern and Plover Conservation Program in 2007, Mary Bomberger Brown studied the social behavior of cliff swallows for about 25 years at Cedar Point Biological Station near Ogallala. Mary's a native Nebraskan. She earned her BS at the University of Nebraska. She studied under Paul Johnsgaard and received her MS from the University of Nebraska, and currently she's working with Larkin Powell on her PhD. The title of her presentation, as you can see on the screen, is A Partnership Model for Sustainable Threatened and Endangered Species Conservation in Nebraska, the Tern and Plover Conservation Partnership. Mary?
Thank you for coming out on this cold and snowy day. We're certainly happy to be here, and hopefully terns and plovers are birds of the summer for us here in Nebraska. So maybe if you can spend an hour or so looking at summertime pictures, you know, birds on the beaches, that'll kind of warm you up and make you forget a little bit about the snow. I would like to talk about the Tern and Plover Conservation Partnership. It's a sustainable conservation organization, a sustainable program. And when I use the word sustainable, and when you see it in the title, I mean sustainable in the typical definition of the word, a program that can be maintained over time, over the years, and also sustainable in terms of being cooperating between all of our partners, being non-confrontational, and being something that can be sustained over time because it's a positive experience in conservation for folks. It's not confrontational, it's common sense. So that's, you know, philosophically where we start from and how we proceed, and hopefully I will be able to make you all, by the time I'm finished speaking, you can agree with me on that. These are our two customers, the two birds that we're worried about. On the left here is the piping plover, and on the right side we have interior lease terns. Birds of Nebraska in the summertime. About the partnership, who we are, we wouldn't have a partnership, we wouldn't have anything that we need to get together and talk about if it weren't for the birds. So the first of our partners do have to be the birds, the terns and the plovers. And then coming down the list, essentially we're a consortium, we're a partnership, we're an aggregation of any group, any individual, any NGO, any agency, anyone with an interest in or a concern about the conservation of threatened and endangered species here in Nebraska in general, and in particular these two species, lease terns and piping plovers. We're based at the University of Nebraska School of Natural Resources out on East Campus. That's where our offices are. We work with the University Extension very closely, so our connection with the University of Nebraska is very important to us. Our funding comes from the Nebraska Environmental Trust. They've been very generous to us over the years. And when we travel around the country and around the world talking about the partnership, when we tell folks about the Environmental Trust, people are fascinated by it, and they compliment us, and what a wonderful thing that Nebraska has a program like that. We work very closely with the Nebraska Game and Parks Commission, particularly the non-game bird program. They provide us with energy, with expertise in policy and in other things, so that's a very useful group for us. The next group we work with are the sand and gravel mining companies. They were instrumental to us in the very beginnings. It was because of them that the partnership actually formed. And so they need to be very high on our list of people that we work with. But then if you just continue down the list, it's anyone who has an interest in the conservation of lease terns and piping plovers in Nebraska and wants to work cooperatively with us on the subject. So our partners. Who are these creatures that we're worried about, conserving and protecting here in the state? Piping plovers, their status on the state and federal endangered species list is threatened. Here you have a little one on the lower left. He hatched the morning this picture was taken. This was taken later in the afternoon, so he's maybe 8 or 10 hours old, and that's probably his father that's attending him. It's gone crazy. Piping plovers, they're small, stocky shorebirds, about 8 inches tall. Think a starling-sized bird. They have sandy-colored backs, a single black necklace, a single black neckband, orange legs, orange beaks. They feed along shorelines of lakes, shorelines of rivers, sandbars. They're at the sand-water interface. They eat worms, larvae, invertebrates, things that are living in the water and in the sand that they can probe, get from the surface. So any pollution or contaminants or anything that's going on in the water is going to be going on and getting into their food. So they can bioaccumulate any toxins or anything that's in the water or in the food that they eat, and that's going to come up, be an important point at the very end of my presentation and something that we need to think about. They arrive in Nebraska in mid-April. They're on nests and raising little ones early May to early August. A bird might be in Nebraska 10 or 12 weeks, so we're only sharing the sand, we're only sharing the state with them for, you know, not that long, 10 or 12 weeks. They lay four eggs. Their nests are, they look like footprints in the sand, on in the sandbars, maybe 4 inches in diameter. They just look like a footprint with four little eggs in them. The eggs hatch around 28 days, and the little ones fledge in another 28 days. And fledge means they're able to maintain sustained flight, and they're independent of their parents. They're able to feed and take care of themselves. They place their nests, these little sandy scrape nests, on open, bare, sparsely vegetated sand, sandbars, things that they find on sandbars in the rivers. They'll find along lake shorelines, places like Lake McConaughey, and waste sand piles. Any broad, open expanses of bare sand is home for these guys. Where do we find them? There's three populations. We can find them along the Atlantic coast of the United States. Think the beaches on Long Island Sound. Think the Jersey Shore. Think, oh, the Outer Banks areas. Think sandy, beachy areas on the Atlantic coast. There's an extremely small population in the Great Lakes, in the sand dune areas up there. And then the large population, or relatively large for an endangered species, in the Great Plains. Nebraska maintains one of the largest remaining single nesting populations of these guys anywhere on the planet, and so we're pleased with that. They are protected by the United States Endangered Species Act. They're given endangered status by the Canadian statute, so they're protected on both sides of the border. Notice in the brown, this is where they spend the winter, down along the Gulf Coast, again on the sandy beaches, on the barrier islands, those areas. And that's actually where they are right now. We're here in the snow, and they're ambling around on the beaches down in the sunny south. One thing that we hear about, a comment that a lot of folks make when we're out visiting with folks, they say, oh gosh, those birds are everywhere. Their plovers are anywhere. They're not endangered. There's no problem with them. Well, they're confusing them with killdeer. So if you see a bird a little bit larger with a more chocolate brown back, two necklaces, two neck bands around, that's going to be a killdeer. If you see a bird with a single necklace on, that's going to be a plover. So yes, there are a lot of killdeer, but no, there's not a lot of plovers. And so look for, you know, the neck band is the distinguishing characteristic. Terns, they are on the state of Nebraska, so the state and federal endangered species list. They have the status of endangered, which means that their populations are a little bit smaller, and that they are in more. We need to be more concerned about them. The maintaining of their populations. They're more endangered. There's a greater problem for them. How do you know a tern? They're the smallest of the terns, 8 or 9 inches long. Think a seagull about the size of a robin, so about that size sort of bird, white. They have a white forehead patch. They don't breed until they're 2 years old. They have a gap year in there. They eat small fish that they capture by hovering over the water and plunging down and catching them. So they eat fish that are living, you know, that are accumulating the things that are in the water that they're living in and swimming in, so the terns can accumulate in their bodies any toxins or any issues that are in the fish and in the water. They arrive a smidgen later than plovers do, early May. They nest mid-May to early August. Again, a bird is probably here in the state 10 or 12 weeks. We don't share Nebraska with them all year long, just a little bit. They lay 2 or 3 eggs. Their nests also are just, they look like footprints in the sand. Their eggs hatch in 21 days or so. The little ones are independent of their parents in another 21 days. And they nest in the same places as plovers do. And so conservation actions or positive actions or negative actions, things that happen to the places where terns live, is also affecting where plovers live. They live together, so if you find a plover nest, it's a fair bet that you're going to find a tern nest. They live together. So we need to think about them and conservation actions that affect them. We need to think of them together. All righty, we're defined terns. Again, there's three populations of these guys, an Atlantic coast population, interior population along our rivers, and then there's a small population in California. They spend the winter down in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Caribbean, in the Atlantic. They're further out to sea, so they too are not experiencing the snow up here like we are. Terns and plovers are part of Nebraska. They've been here since forever. There are terms for terns and plovers in the languages of the Native Americans. The First Peoples have stories of them that they include. They were here when the European explorers first came to Nebraska and started to pass through the area. They greeted Lewis and Clark on August 5th, 1804, near the Engineer Cantonment area near Omaha. Terns were the first species of bird that Lewis and Clark, the new species that they described in their journals. So they were here then. They mentioned in the same report in their journals, they discussed piping plovers as well. The Stephen Long expedition saw terns and plovers near the Missouri Platte River confluence, kind of down in Cass County. Paul Wilhelm saw them in 1823. Audubon, when he was passing through Nebraska on one of his trips across the country, 1843, saw them in the area up near Ponca, Sioux City, that part of the world, that part of the state. And the Warren expedition, they went further up the Platte River, and they have extensive reports and in the expedition notes of seeing terns and plovers nesting on sandbars near the Loop Confluence, so near present-day Columbus. We also have reports of these guys from the pioneers, you know, along the Oregon Trail and the Mormon Trail, folks seeing them on sandbars in the rivers. There are reports from Keith County at the western end of what's now Lake McConaughey, so they've been up in the North Platte River. And for those of you who are from Lincoln that are familiar with the Lincoln area, there are even reports of these birds nesting in the area of what's now Capitol Beach. Capitol Beach was originally a salt mine, and so these birds back in the 18-whatevers, they were known to be nesting on the beaches around the Pitt Lake at the salt mine out there. Where did Lewis and Clark and Audubon and all these folks see terns and plovers nesting? Well, they saw them on sandbars like we see in the top there in our rivers in the middle of the Platte, the Loop, the Elkhorn, the Niobrara, Calamus, all the open sandy rivers of Nebraska that had sandbars in them. That's where these guys nest. But with all the changes we've made to the rivers over the years, you know, with irrigation usage and hydrocycling from hydropower development, you know, usage of water for urban demands, we've made enough changes to the rivers that the sandbars that used to look like in the above photo are now looking like these ones in the lower photo. They support gallery forests. They're covered with invasive species, Phragmites, salt cedar, purple loosestrife, things like that. So sandbars that should be, that for birds that are looking for something like in the top photo nest, they're coming back and finding sandbars that look a lot like this, but they still want to nest here. They're still looking for places to nest. So what do they do here in Nebraska? Well, we have other areas of sand here in the state that the birds are exploiting. Because the rivers of Nebraska carry a lot of sand and gravel in their bed loads that, you know, it's carried down the rivers with the water. The Loop River, you know, it comes up in the sand hill, so it carries a lot of sandy sediment down. The Platte, North and South Platte, carry erosional debris from the Rocky Mountains, so there's a lot of sand and gravel. And these riverbeds, you know, have moved across the landscape over the years, and they've deposited their sand, which has left substantial deposits, which we have mining companies, aggregate mining companies, that are extracting the sand and gravel, and it's a substantial industry here in the state. It's used for road construction, sand on the roads. I will be very happy to have it on the way home this afternoon, the sand from these mines out on the roads. So it's an important industry that we have here in the state. Most of these mines are within 2 or 3 miles of the river. So if a bird is coming up looking for a sandbar in the river to nest, there's nothing there. It very easily can find the sand spill piles at these sand mines as places to put down their nests. Now, they're not nesting on the top of the peaks there, of the hills. That's the aggregate. That's the sand that the mining companies do sell. They will put their nest down on these flatter, more sandbar-y looking areas. When the mines age out and are taken out of production, they very commonly, well, generally, are turned into lakeshore housing developments. That's quite a lucrative industry here in the state. You can have a little bit of oceanfront property right here in the Great Plains. up there in the top, that's a whole lot like what a lakeshore housing development looks like. The birds still see that sand as perfectly good places to nest. It's a sandbar, and so they're dropping down there to nest. Here they're nesting on private industrial property. Up above, they're nesting on private residential property. They're still on nesting on privately owned property. They're still legally protected. You know, the issue, there are issues that come with that we still need to be aware of. They nest the upper, I guess the upper right-hand corner to you guys is just a dredging operation. The birds see that sand is perfectly good sandbars and places to nest. They'll drop down there. And in the lower corner is a power plant. The birds are willing to place their nests on the fly ash piles at coal-fired power plants. They've been known to do that. The other place, we haven't seen it here in Nebraska yet, or really in the northern Great Plains, but the terns have been known to put their nests on tar gravel rooftops, you know, like big flat warehouses, how they, you know, they spread tar and sand and gravel on it. If you're a bird and flying by and you're looking for a sandbar to nest on, that must look pretty darn good. So it's not uncommon. In Florida, we see that mostly. There have been reports of it in Texas, in the Dallas area, sort of north of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. That generally doesn't work out well for them. The tar gets hot. There's unpleasantness. So that generally doesn't work out well for them. When we talk about birds being on the endangered species list, there is a regulatory element to that. It is, you know, the letter of the law. There are legal protections for these birds. Terns and plovers are protected by three statutes. Two of them are federal. One was a state statute. The first one is the Federal Endangered Species Act. It was enacted in 1973. It's been amended since then, but that's the one statute that protects them mostly. They are also protected by the Federal International Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. This was enacted. This is one of the first conservation pieces of conservation legislation in the country. It was an effort by Teddy Roosevelt, and there's a book called Wilderness Warrior written by someone who I can't think of the name right now, but it discusses this law, the reason behind it and why it's in place. But a very important law to protect the birds that we have here in North America. And in Nebraska, we have the Non-Game and Endangered Species Conservation Act that was of 1975. There's a lot of verbiage, you know, in words in all these statutes, but it comes down to that it's against the law to take terns and plovers. And the word take has very specific meaning. It means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or to attempt to engage in that. And it's unlawful to possess any parts of a bird. There are details that go along with the law, but grossly, that's what the Endangered Species Act asks us to respect. The fines can be as high as $100,000, 1 year in prison, or both. Most prosecutions are under the federal statutes. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is a regulatory agency that handles the Endangered Species Act. The Nebraska Game and Parks Commission handles the enforcement of the non-game, the NESCA Act. What does the Nebraska Act say? In Nebraska here, any species that's on the federal list is also on the state list. It prohibits take of any listed species, with take being defined as the same way as in the federal statute. Essentially, state agencies are asked to consult with the Game and Parks Commission and their policy folks before they take any actions that jeopardize a listed species. Things like the Department of Roads is going to be putting in a bridge or renovating a bridge or dredging somewhere. Things like that. They're asked to consult with the Game and Parks Commission to get the okay, and if there's any details that need to be worked out before the things proceed. It allows for the implementation of conservation programs like the Tern and Plover Partnership to be enacted to take to be in place to benefit listed species, and also it allows for funds for listed species to be contributed to the protection of listed species through the state income tax returns checkoff. So April 15th, when you're filling out your income tax forms, consider a check for wildlife. It goes to good causes. Game and Parks does good things for us. The language of the laws may seem fairly draconian to us. You know, it's against the law to do all these things. And that's intended to prevent scenes like this from happening. This bird had a nest on a beach. It was defending its chicks. And it was run down by someone on an ATV. Not a good thing to have happen. So The notion is to prevent this sort of thing from happening, this sort of sadness from happening. So why are we concerned about these two species? Why have the populations declined to such a point that they need these legal protections? Why do they need law enforcement? Why do they need to have all the protections and the things that are being done for them? Well, for terns and plovers, three things happened to them back around the turn of the last century, plus or minus 1900s. It was quite the fashion for women mostly, you know, men did this a bit, but to have feathers or parts of birds or entire birds on their hats. I can't imagine going around with a stuffed bird on my head, but apparently it was quite the fashion, and I can't imagine being up here and seeing all of you guys out there with stuffed birds on your heads, but apparently at that time that was quite the fashion. A lot of birds were killed, particularly birds that had long plumes or feathers of interesting colors. It was, a lot of birds suffered and died. Nesting habitat loss, if the birds don't have a place to reproduce, they don't have a place to put their nests, raise their young safely, the populations are going to decline. Natural attrition, birds die. And if they aren't replaced, the population size is going to drop. So if they've lost nesting habitat, we're going to lose populations. And wintering habitat loss, if they don't have a place to live in the wintertime, they're not going to survive that time of year, and they're not going to be able to come back and reproduce. So they're being hunted, they're being persecuted for their feathers, for their plumes, and they don't have a place to reproduce, and they don't have a place to spend the winter. The net effect of that is that the populations decline, the populations drop. So I want to talk for a couple of minutes about how and why these two species were placed on the endangered species list. That's oftentimes not well understood by folks. It's something that the Fish and Wildlife Service does. It's well considered before a species is put on the endangered species list, but that's not always well understood by the public. So let's talk about piping plovers, how it happened for them. In 1982, in the Federal Register, the Fish and Wildlife Service published a notice of review, said that they are considering putting piping plovers on the endangered species list. And they were assigned a Category 2 status, which says that there is reason to believe that the populations are declining, that there is concern, and that we need more information from the public, from scientists, from researchers, to assess whether the populations are low enough that they need the additional protections. Two years passed, the Fish and Wildlife Service, again published in the Federal Register, the suggestion that the Great Lakes population, I believe, was down to 27 pairs at that point, was endangered, and then the other populations should be threatened. A year later, again, there was a request for commentary from the public at this. A year later, the final rule was published saying that, yes, they do need to be placed on the endangered species list. It finally happened in 1986, and 4 years later, the recovery plan for this species was published. When a species is placed on the endangered species list, the goal is to increase their populations, to recover them through the implementation of these recovery plans. Recovery plans are written by a panel of experts, people that know the most about these species, and they assemble a list of activities, what needs to be accomplished before the species can be taken off the list. And every 5 years, these plans are to be reviewed and revised. Now, the next slide has an awful lot of words on it, but I thought you might want to see specifically for the Great Plains population of piping plovers what we have to do before they can be taken off the endangered species list. And I need to point out that the plans are written specifically for the species and reflect the biology of the species involved. So here in the Great Plains, we are to get 1,300 pairs of these things and to have 1,300 pairs for 15 years. We're asked to have them distributed across the landscape in this way. So instead of having 1,300 pairs of birds in one big spot, we want to have them across the landscape because that adds additional protections to them. If there's a storm in Montana, well, the birds in Nebraska are probably going to be okay. So we want to spread them across the landscape. In Nebraska, we are asked to have 465 pairs, which is, 930 birds here. And they are to be distributed in the four main river systems like we have there. The numbers in red indicate what the estimated population sizes are as of 2010, when the 10-year review or the 5-year review of the species came out. We're doing pretty well on the Platte River. maybe halfway for the other rivers. We're making progress. A lot of the birds on the Platte River are out at Lake McConaughey, and they were, during the drought of the past decade, you know, the lake levels were down a great deal, a lot of sand, it attracted a lot of birds. Now that the lake levels have gone up, there is no sand, and we don't know where those birds are going to go. We're guessing that they're going to come down the Platte River. They may come down to the Central Platte and the Lower Platte. We'll find out. But that sort of gives you a sense of why we're asked to maintain them for a fair amount of time, for 15 years. You know, there's things happen on the landscapes. There's droughts, there's floods. The birds are going to move around. We're also asked to maintain a fledging rate, how many little ones we make every year. We're asked to make a little over one plover chick per year. We're making about a plover and a quarter per nest. As of 2010, we have 1,200 pairs in the Great Plains. So we're close to what we're close to the numbers that we're supposed to have for to delist these guys, but they're not quite distributed the way they need to be. Terns, it took a little bit longer for them to be placed on the endangered species list. A group of folks from the Oklahoma Ornithological Society, led by John Tomer, actually, solicited the service to consider this species for review. 7 years later, they started off, again, assigned them Category 2 status like plovers were, asking for public comment, asking for public input, including the public in the designation. 2 years later, or 1 year, however, whatever the number of months are, the petition was warranted. The sense was that, yes, terns are in trouble. The populations are dropping. We need to help them out. Later that year, they were given proposed endangered status, officially listed at the same time plovers were, and the recovery plan was released 2 years later. The five-year review of this species is still underway, so I can't really tell you where we're at with that, how many birds we've produced. But I can tell you what the recovery plan looks like and what we are supposed to accomplish before we can take them off the endangered species list. Notice that it's written in a very different way. This is the number of adult birds instead of number of pairs. And we need to keep these numbers for 10 years instead of 15. And the distribution is based on river systems as opposed to states like it was for the plovers. It made sense to the recovery team to produce the recovery plan to have it look like this. In Nebraska, we need to have a little over 1,000 of the birds. Some on the Missouri, the Niobrara, the Loop. I would bet here in the Platte River, I know maybe 400, 450 that we have in the Platte River. We're making progress, I think. And we are asked to make 7/10 of a tern chick per year. I wish I could tell you how we're doing with that, but at the moment I can't. Not surprisingly, there was opposition to the listing of these two species. It came in three flavors. First, that there was concern that the listing status could curtail water projects and economic development along our rivers in the state. Things like irrigation, use of water for cities, hydropower generation, concerns of economic nature. There was concern that the data used to support the listing was inadequate, that we simply didn't know enough about the birds and how they were distributed across the landscape to be able to say that they were endangered. And finally, there was concern that the listing status did not include a critical habitat designation. The Endangered Species Act, you know, it protects the species themselves, but it also asks that the habitat, the places that they live, be protected as well. And it was not included for terns and plovers because of the ephemeral nature of their nesting habitat, sandbars. A sandbar that might be in the river this year, by next year sometime, is probably eroded and well on its way down to the Mississippi Delta. We don't know. So it is an ephemeral habitat. Eventually, critical habitat was designated for piping plovers. It was about 10 years after they were placed on the endangered species list, the Defenders of Wildlife. That conservation organization petitioned the federal courts to define critical habitat for piping plovers. 4 years later, the court acted on this petition. The critical habitat, the service was asked to provide critical habitat. A year later, it was designated in the five northern Great Plains states, and here in Nebraska, which is what the next slide is, what I'm going to talk about in a minute, a little over 400 miles of our rivers, The shorelines of our rivers was designated as critical habitat and necessary for these birds to survive and to reproduce and to become, to their populations to recover. There was a challenge to this in the state. A group of water users, the Nebraska Habitat Conservation Coalition, water users, power companies, individuals with concerns about how the economic use of water here in the state, filed a lawsuit, petitioned the courts to vacate the critical habitat designation, saying that the service did not consider the economic impact of the issue, and that the science behind the listing status was not adequate, that we didn't know enough about the birds to actually cause them to be listed. 2 years later, the federal court in Omaha vacated the critical habitat for plovers here in Nebraska. It does remain in place in other states. The following year, the service announced that they would appeal this ruling. The Conservation Coalition said they would appeal the appeal. And at the moment, nothing is moving. Everything is in place the way it is. And so at the moment, there's no critical habitat for piping plovers here in Nebraska, here in the state. And since terns and plovers nest in effectively the same areas, if there's no critical habitat for plovers, well, there's effectively no critical habitat for terns, even though terns never had critical habitat designated for them here in the state. Which brings me to the Tern and Plover Conservation Partnership. It took me a lot of words and sentences and paragraphs to get to this point, but you guys needed to know all of that before I could talk about who we are and what we do. In the early 1990s, there were a couple of very unpleasant violations of the Endangered Species Act here in the state. The concern was mostly for leased terns. A number of birds were killed, their nests were destroyed, nesting areas were just gone, which not a good thing. The conflict over critical habitat was going on at about this same time. And there was an increasing number of plovers and terns nesting on human-created habitats. More birds were nesting on mines, at housing developments, these dredging areas. Terns and plovers were coming into where people live and work and play more and more during this time. So it became clear that a different way of doing conservation of these two species, protecting these two species, we needed to find a better way of doing that. So in what was at that time, and still is, a far-seeing resolution to the Endangered Species Act violations, the prosecutors and the judges and all the parties involved placed the funds from the violations into a fund to find a way to better protect these things. And the study was completed by Janine Lackey. It was a master's degree here at the university in, I believe, community and urban planning, I think is true. And that eventually led to the founding of the Tern and Plover Partnership in 1999. So a lot of words to get us to this point. What do we do? Since the initial violations were with the sand and gravel mining company, our efforts to protect these birds were focused on sand and gravel mining companies. What the need was, in its simplest form, we needed to facilitate the mining company's access to their aggregate and their revenue streams, at the same time protecting the birds and their revenue streams. We had to find a way that people and birds could share the sand. You know, fair is fair. You know, the birds are only here in the state for 10 or 12 weeks. We can share the sand for that short period of time. So what do we do? We visit with the mining companies. They provide us with information, precise information, on where they are going to be producing, where they're going to be removing aggregate during the nesting season, during the time that the birds are here. And once we know that, we can make those areas unattractive to the birds, and then we can make areas in another part of the mine or where the birds are going to be nesting, make that more attractive. The humans stay over here and mine and do what they need to do. The birds come over here and have nests and do what they need to do over here. We're keeping the two parties apart. No birds are injured or harmed or harassed in any way. It's simply a matter of we make this area unattractive so the humans can stay here. We make this area attractive to the birds, and the birds come over here and nest. We also have started to do this at lakeshore housing developments. It's a bit more complex for us because we have more property owners. We have more people and companies and individuals involved, but it works well there as well. The net effect is an economic win-win. The companies maintain their production and their revenue streams, income. They sell aggregate. They tax revenues to the state and to the local agencies. So the economic aspect for the mining companies and the real estate companies and construction companies persists. And also the birds maintain their revenue stream, which in their case, there's chicks, it's babies, eggs. So it's an economic win-win for everybody. Essentially, we recognize that our partners, they want to have a voice in the conservation process. They wanted to be part of it. They wanted to be part of the discussion. They didn't want to have it put upon them. Yes, sir, Bob, do you have a question?
Are you going to talk about what constitutes making areas attractive and unattractive?
We can talk about it later if you'd like. The notion was that our partners wanted to be part of the conservation process. They didn't want to have it put upon them, which is how they felt it had been with the prosecutions for the Endangered Species Act violations. This procedure, this economic win-win, has had advantages in other ways. If you look in the center photo up on the top, on the middle on the left, you'll see a wire cage. There's a plover nest inside of that. And the house is being constructed in the background. The people are doing what they need to do. The birds are doing what they need to do. Both of their revenue streams are continuing. And things worked out very well for them. This procedure has had another effect where what began as just a conservation action for these two birds, the mining companies, the utility companies, the construction companies, are now implementing other conservation actions within their companies and on their properties. So what began as a very focused thing has spread out and has become a larger success, and we're pleased with that. What are some of the other successes of the partnership model? If you think about it, here below is a dredging operation. The river is in the back. The dredging operation is the front. And from an environmental perspective, you know, that is destructive. It's ugly. There's levees, there's revetments, you know, it's not pleasant looking. And from an economic perspective, mining and construction are important part of the state. They're a huge part of the state's economy, tax revenue, jobs. You know, they're important parts of the state. And these industries and these real estate and mining, they're not going to go away. I mean, realistically, they're not. And people want, and the law requires, the protection of threatened and endangered species. And the protection of our natural resources. So we have to find a way to recognize that we need to have jobs, we need to have economic things, but we also need to protect our natural resources and our environment. And we found a way, the partnership model, the partnership process, we found a way that it all works for us, that we can do conservation cooperatively. And in a common sense manner, that it's not confrontational, and it seems to be working, at least for us here in the state, and we're very pleased with that. We also have a program where we're trying to get the birds off of these human created habitats, get them off the mines, get them off the housing developments, and to get them back on sandbars in the river. That's where they belong. That's where Mother Nature wants them. And so we have a program where we're renovating sandbars. There's actually a mine just on the other side of these trees. And so we'd like to see the birds nesting out here on the sandbars instead of nesting on the mine and potentially getting into trouble over there. We also have a research program going on, trying to understand the birds a bit more. We can't really protect them unless we know more about them. Part of the next story I want to tell you depends on piping plovers and the fact that we've been able to color band a lot of them. If you look at their legs, you're going to see different colored leg bands on them. If you see the birds on the left, they have a light blue flag on their upper leg. That flag indicates that they come from the Platte River. The bird on the right, if you see a green flag on its upper leg, that indicates that it comes from the Missouri River. Birds from North Dakota get yellow flags. Canada, they get black or white flags. The Great Lakes, they get orange flags. So you can look at a bird's legs, you can look at the color band combination, and you know where it comes from. And that can give you a great deal of information. And since these are migratory birds, where they're sighted in other times of the year can give us an idea of what things that are impinging on their lives down here are going to affect them up here in Nebraska and what we do in terms of conservation for them. And so, the final story I'd like to tell you about is the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. It's off the news, but it's still not gone. What happened 1,000 miles away down in the Gulf of Mexico actually is affecting us up here, and it's a very real concern. I'm sure you remember seeing all the photos of the oiled birds, oiled pelicans, oiled gannets. A couple of least tern colonies were oiled and destroyed, apparently. The photos in the top are areas where piping plovers spend the winter. They run around on sandy beaches like that. You'll see the oil coming up towards the beaches. The water's coming up. The oil's coming up onto the sand, so it's probably contaminating the food, the things that they eat. The two photos down here in the left side, oily water, terns plunge down into the water, capture fish that they consume, that they eat. And this map indicates where our plovers here in Nebraska spend the wintertime. The pink dot is in the area of Schuyler. The red dot is in the area of Ashland. And so if you follow the lines down, you can see that our birds, you know, the bulk of them are going down here, Aransas, Corpus Christi, that area. Just the past, about 2 weeks ago, we got a report of a bird being in this area here. But you can see that a lot of our birds here in Nebraska are going into the oiled areas where oil did come ashore because of the Deepwater Horizon BP spill. This little one, this photograph was taken in September. The water he's standing in is not actively, it's not oiled. It doesn't have the big gloppy oil like we were seeing on the news this summer, but it is sheened. And this little one, his egg hatched on the 23rd of June of this last year. His nest was at a site near North Bend. This photo was taken in September, so he's about 3 months old. I met him on his birthday, on the day his egg hatched, so he's my friend. But he is standing up to his color bands in oily water, in messy water, and so he's sticking his beak into the sand and feeding on things that's living in the oily water. He's probably accumulating those any toxins, any chemicals from what he's eating into his body. This may well and probably will affect his ability to reproduce up here in Nebraska next summer. That's something that we're very concerned about. This bird here, judging from his leg bands, he is from the population in the Central Platte River, you know, the Kearney, Elm Creek, Lexington, Grand Island, that area. Judging from his bands, he's probably 3 years old in this picture. What you're seeing on the sand on the beaches, much of that is just normal beach detritus, you know, rocks and sand and stuff. But some of the little bitty things that you're seeing in the picture are little bitty teeny weeny tar balls that are left over from the chemical dispersants that were used to break up the oil spill. They sort of look like, mouse droppings, little things. So the terns, those aren't least terns actually, but the terns and this little guy, the plover, are running around and standing on beaches that actually do have the chemical dispersants in the oil that was left over from the oil spill. This is a concern for us. And, you know, we all ride around on the same planet here. What happens here in Nebraska is going to happen, is going to affect the birds in other parts of the range, and what's happening in other parts of the range is going to affect them here. The Fish and Wildlife Service, the Audubon Societies, the American Birds Conservancy, you know, a lot of the agencies, the people that think about birds on a grander, more larger scale, have described what they think will be an oil shadow coming up into North America this next year and for the years following it. If you think about it, you know, we're right here in the middle of North America, and most of the birds to the west of the Rocky Mountains are going to migrate and just go down the west coast and probably not be affected by the oil. But the birds east of the Rocky Mountains, they migrate. Some migrate down through Mexico and Central America, and so they'll largely bypass the oil and not be affected. But a lot of the things that they fly down, stop, break their southerly migration on the Gulf, stop, feed there, you know, spend some time. Some spend the entire winter there. Many will go fly across the Gulf down to the Yucatan or South America, spend the winter there, turn around, and when in the springtime, when they get across the Gulf, they'll drop down into those areas and be stopping and feeding and being dependent on the areas that were oiled for sustenance to get them back up to the rest of their nesting areas. What effect is that going to have on them? We don't know. We won't know for the next several years. We'll have to wait and find out. But it is a concern. These Fish and Wildlife Service published a list of 38 species that they are expecting to be particularly injured or affected by the oil. And least terns and piping plovers are two of the species on that list. And so that makes us very concerned about that. But we won't know the effect of the oil on our birds for the next couple of years. We have to keep our eyes out on that. But it makes us think that conservation actions, things that we can do to protect these species up here in Nebraska, are now a little bit more important just because of things that have happened in other parts of their range. What we do here is not independent of what happens in other parts of the range. We need to think more globally than perhaps we do. And that, I would like to thank all of you for coming and listening to me go on about terns and plovers. I am capable of chattering on about these things for great lengths of time. And we also want to thank all of our partners in terns and plover conservation. We think that we're doing good things here, and we're quite sure the terns and plovers are grateful.